Okay, so one of the less understood things about an hour-long podcast is that it actually takes quite a few hours behind the scenes to make. You're lining up different people's schedules, you're writing scripts, editing audio, making it feel effortless actually takes a bit of effort. That's why I want to recommend Notion. Notion is a place where any team can write, plan, organize, and rediscover the joy of play. It's a workspace designed not just for making progress, but getting inspired too, so that when it comes time to hit the record button, everyone's on the same page, or TeamSpace, or Calendar, or QuickNote, have a play around, they're all there. Notion combines your collaborations into one space that's simple and clear, and it also has some AI running in the background to help things along. Try Notion for free when you go to notion.com/squared. And just an FYI, that's all lowercase letters, notion.com/squared, lowercase. So you can start turning ideas into action. And when you use the link, you're supporting what we do here on the show too. That's notion.com/squared.
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Hello, podcast listeners. I'm Connor, and welcome to this week's episode of Intelligence Squared. Today, we're joined by Nicole Perlroth, cybersecurity reporter at the New York Times and author of the new book, This Is How They Tell Me the World Ends, The Cyber Weapons Arms Race. And in conversation with Josh Glancy, the Washington bureau chief of the Times and Sunday Times, they discussed the world of cyber hacking, from nation states hacking into the critical infrastructure of other countries, right through to the growth of the cyber weapons arms market. It's a really fascinating conversation, which has a lot to tell us about stories we've seen in the news recently, such as the SolarWinds hack. And if you do enjoy it, you can find a link for Nicole's book in the podcast description. But now, let's go to the episode.
I'm Josh Glancy, and I'm very pleased to welcome Nicole Perlroth here, who is a reporter at the New York Times and the author of This Is How They Tell Me the World Ends, which, if you were feeling like relaxed after the Trump administration ending, I would not recommend reading before bed, but is a fascinating book, a very absorbing book, a very, very detailed dive into the world of cyber warfare, really, and the Wild West of cyber warfare, as done by many sorts of freelance organizations, dark organizations, and governments too, and really takes us deep into this quite strange and scary world. So to start off, Nicole, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and how you came to report on this increasingly apocalyptic beat?
Well, it's not that impressive a story. I was a technology journalist. I covered venture capital and startups around 2008 when these VCs started to look like celebrities, at least to themselves, because they had invested early in Facebook and Twitter. And I was writing cover stories about Peter Thiel and some of the other early investors in Facebook. And it caught the Times notice around 2008, 2009, and they called me and said, we're looking at you for this job, but we're not sure you are going to want it. And I said, well, how bad could it be? You're the Times, I'll probably just take anything it is and try my best. And they said, it's cybersecurity. And I like rolled my eyes and it's like, cybersecurity is so boring. I've gone out of my way to not learn anything about cybersecurity. I'm sure there are other people who would be more qualified for this job. I know a few of them. And they said, well, we've interviewed those people and we had no idea what they were talking about. You're hired. So began my illustrious entry into the world of cybersecurity. So, you know, this was 2010 when I first started at the Times. And back then, the big threat was Anonymous. You remember, it was this loose hacking collective.
Gosh, that is a throwback. Yeah.
Right? I mean, it seems so quaint.
I haven't had that word for a while.
Oh, my God. Yeah. And it just consumed my life. You know, these denial of service attacks where they flooded these websites with traffic till they collapsed. And it was basically anyone who could fall was falling to these attacks. But sometimes it was more interesting targets like the CIA website. But of course, yes, that was 10 years ago and it all seems very quaint now. You know, the Chinese were hacking our intellectual property and no one wanted to talk about it. People who learned that they had been hacked by China didn't want to talk about it because they were afraid what it would do to their stock price. And that became a big reporting target for me because there was this famous saying that I think can now be credited first to Dmitry Alperovitch, that there were only two types of companies left in the United States, companies that had been hacked and companies that didn't know they'd been hacked yet. And the silent part of that phrase was by China. You know, they were really infiltrating any company they could and stealing our IP. And no one wanted to talk about it. But then the best thing and worst thing happened, which is the New York Times got hacked by China. And I was able to embed with our security team and Mandiant, which would go on to get acquired by FireEye and the FBI, and watch as the guy we called the Beijing summer intern roll into our networks at 10 a.m. Beijing time and roll out at 4:30 and try and mine our emails for source information and that kind of thing. So that was really my entry, real entry into this world.
And so your book is the culmination of several years reporting on all of this. And as you point out, it's a fast moving field. I mean, it's evolved enormously, I imagine, in the decade that you've been covering it. I think that it was the New York Times review of your book called it the most serious security risk facing America. Do you agree with that as an overarching statement? And could you explain, if so, why? There are obviously a lot of threats we think about. Why is this one the most grave?
You know, if you'd asked me 3 months ago, I would have said yes. Now, I actually think domestic terrorism is the biggest threat we face. Mm. After I sat there and watched the January 6th events, my stomach just sank. And I thought, how are we going to solve cybersecurity when we can't even stop our own people from believing this giant lie and breaking into the Capitol and rubbing their feces all over the place? I mean, that is the biggest threat I think we face today. But in terms of cybersecurity, we are here in the United States and probably the UK and Israel as well and some of our closest allies, but really the United States is the most sophisticated cyber superpower in the world. We pulled off an attack more than 10 years ago on an Iranian nuclear facility with Israel called Stuxnet or Olympic Games, which was the classified code name. And we took out their centrifuges with code. No one has ever come anywhere close. That said, 10 years later, we are still the most advanced, but that lead is slipping. We have more adversaries knocking on our door probably than any other country in the world because they see we have systems of interest here. And they see that they have an asymmetrical advantage in cyberspace, and they know they'll never be able to match us on the battlefield because we pour more money into our kinetic warfare programs than any other country in the world. But they've seen what they can do with code. They see that what they can even do with rudimentary code that can wipe out data and ransomware and that kind of thing. And not only are we the most targeted these days, we're the most vulnerable, arguably, because we are the most digitized. You know, we bought into this idea 10 years ago from those venture capitalists and Facebooks and Twitters and companies I used to cover in Silicon Valley. We bought into their promise of this frictionless society where we could plug up anything we wanted and access it with our phones and not just Uber, but critical infrastructure like our water treatment facilities and power grid, nuclear plants, airplanes, air traffic control. And because we are so wired, all of those connections become targets for hackers who want to see destruction play out here. So, you know, we are the most advanced. We are also the most vulnerable and targeted.
And does America's openness as a society, which obviously is broadly seen as a strength, at least by Americans, does that also amplify its vulnerability in this area?
Yes, it's so interesting. This is the question that I keep asking myself with SolarWinds, with the Russian attack on our government networks, because let's just look at Russia for a minute. You know, Russia in 2016, what did they do? They found our sweet spot in America's partisanship divide and they exploited it against us. They turned us on each other. We turned ourselves on each other, but they poured a lot of fuel on that. With the SolarWinds attack, they have likewise used our democracy and our privacy protections against us because in that case, what they did was They broke into an American company, used it as a conduit to get into the company's clients at the Department of Energy and State Department, but also utilities, and more than 400 of the Fortune 500 used that software. But they pulled off the attack from a command and control server, not in Russia or some other country that they used as a staging site. They did it from New Jersey. They did it from using GoDaddy and Amazon Web Services. Those are places the NSA doesn't look, because we don't want them to look at our domestic Americans' data and systems. So they really flipped our constitution on us, and they brilliantly exploited the seams in our democracy against us. And I don't know what the answer to that is. You know, in Israel, they maintain the ability to help companies and critical infrastructure operators defend themselves from cyber threats. And that entails giving the government access to those systems. After Snowden, we have no appetite for that. Google doesn't want the NSA inside its servers. They don't even want them as close to the periphery of their servers as they can get, which is where we learned the NSA was getting in and sniffing their traffic. So, you know, this is a really big problem, and it seems technical on the one hand, but my goal with the book is to make sure that these people realize these discussions in many ways aren't that technical, and to sort of relinquish control of some of these debates to the everyday American and understand sort of what the stakes are for all of us.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to say to you that the book goes a long way because it's written in quite a accessible sort of storytelling way. Goes quite a long way into bringing the characters and the world of cyber warfare, you know, to the individual. But it does still seem to me like this is something that we are consistently very complacent about. Obviously, it's a fast-moving industry, so it's hard to keep up with, frankly, as an ordinary person. But also, there's something quite intangible sometimes about hacking, even when you have hacking of, you know, when they hacked that adultery website, I can't remember what it was called now, but...
Ashley Madison, yes.
Yes, Ashley Madison, gosh, again, seems quaint, but was a huge story for a while. You would think that would really resonate, it really cut into people's everyday lives, you know, having your adultery exposed online is like, you know, pretty about as personal as it gets. But we do, from my perspective anyway, seem just broadly as a society complacent about this. I think that's probably one of the reasons you wrote this book, but why do you think we are complacent? What do you think the roots of that are?
Well, one, it's just an invisible threat. You know, it actually is helpful to have the pandemic playing out right now, because likewise, it's an invisible threat until it touches you. And that's when you feel it. The same is true in cyber. It's an invisible threat until it touches you. And in the beginning, it wasn't touching us in the most visceral of ways. You know, if our credit card information was stolen, the bank replaced our credit card and recouped the losses for us. If our personal data was stolen, that was a bigger problem. But, you know, we were told just change your passwords, you'll be okay. Now, these attacks are playing out in a much more visceral way. You know, every attack I've covered over the last 10 years has been a slightly more destructive or deadly version than the last. That's not the case with espionage sometimes, but look at where we are. I mean, hospitals are getting ransomwared. It's not just wiping out patient data, it's keeping chemo patients from getting their chemotherapy. It's turning people away from urgent care when they need it. It's SolarWinds is, you know, this Russian attack. Yes, we believe it was designed for espionage, and thank God they were after emails and strategy planning documents, so far as we can tell. And thank God, if we're right, that it's the SVR, that they're quiet prowlers, they're not Sandworm, who use these same access points to turn off the lights, to wipe data, to paralyze vaccine production supplies at Merck in one case and Pfizer. So, you know, we don't really feel it, but the thing people don't understand is we're two clicks away from that same access being used to turn off the lights. We're talking about a country that had no problem with turning off the lights in Ukraine, that had no problem with using code to decimate data, not just in Ukraine, but boomerang down around the world to places like FedEx and Pfizer, et cetera. And then, you know, people have been making this joke because of the timing, but Friday before my book came out, it turns out hackers got into a water treatment facility in Florida and upped the level of lye, L-Y-E, in the water from 100 parts per million to 11,000 parts per million, and could have badly sickened, if not killed, people if some engineer hadn't been sitting at his screen watching this cursor move around while his hand was sitting still and then later go into those functions. So that's very visceral. And I think this is the thing with this book. This is why it's called This Is How They Tell Me the World Ends, not This Is How the World Will End, is because it gives me sort of a degree of distance. But for a long time, people warned me we were going to have this cyber 9/11, cyber Pearl Harbor. We haven't had it yet, but I don't think they're, you know, I used to think that was alarmist. I don't think so anymore. I think we're inching very close to that attack. And my hope is that with people waking up to these smaller close calls, we might be able to actually do something to stave off that attack.
So to look at the overall narrative of the book for a moment, it really comes across as the tale of American hubris. There's this sense of great power that America has at the beginning of the century, that it's the world leader in all this stuff. It has all the best funding, it has the cutting edge. You know, you talk about the NSA's overreach earlier, and America's going great guns with this stuff, and the Stuxnet virus in Iran, which was what, 2010, I believe. I remember at the time it was hailed as a triumph. It was this astonishing moment where America and Israel working together severely damaged Iranian nuclear ambitions without having to send, you know, bunker bombers and all sorts of incredibly expensive and dangerous military hardware over Iran. It was seen as a triumph. However, in your narrative, what it actually looks like in retrospect is perhaps a bit of a opening of a Pandora's box, if you like. So I wonder if you could just take me through that narrative of how America went from really running the table in this area to now, you know, still obviously, as you say, a world leader, but somewhat on the back foot too.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it was both. You know, it was fascinating in the book to go back to the geopolitical context at that time that they developed Stuxnet. I forgot about so much of this. You know, it wasn't distant history, but it was distant enough in the realm of cybersecurity because so much happens that you sort of forget these things. But starting around 2006, Iran was threatening to bomb, like you said, Natanz nuclear facility. They'd made good on these threats before. And where we were in the United States, you have to remember, we were overstretched in the war in Iraq and Afghanistan. The body count that year, I was actually working for Ted Kennedy, and one of my jobs was to tell the senator every day what the latest death count was from Iraq. And it was climbing almost to its peak that year. And when I talked to NSA hackers at that time, they described an Israeli psyop where these Israeli officials would come to Fort Meade and basically put as much pressure as you could possibly imagine, psychological pressure, on NSA and on the White House to hand over our bunker buster bombs. They knew that they couldn't actually destroy Natanz without them. And they really...
Can you just clarify, when you say Natanz,
That's the Iranian nuclear facility. Their uranium enrichment facility that they poured a lot of their resources into. And at the time, George W. had no appetite for going to war with Iran. Every simulation the Pentagon did at the time, if Israel bombed Natanz, every simulation that we did showed that we would be dragged into World War III. And in his second term, W. didn't want to be involved in a third war in the Middle East. And there was a good chance we would lose because we were so outstretched. So he said famously, get me a third option. And that third option, there was one other detail here I report in the book that I had not heard before or seen reported anywhere, which is around this time, Israel started running test flights from Tel Aviv to Greece. And they were sending their F-16s and helicopters on these big, loud test flights. And it wasn't a coincidental distance. It actually turns out that the distance from Tel Aviv to the Acropolis is the same distance as Tel Aviv to Natanz. They were basically saying, we're doing this with or without you. So Bush got this third option from his generals at the NSA. And the third option was, we think we can get into the rotors. The rotors that spin the uranium centrifuges are probably the most fragile part of the uranium enrichment infrastructure. 10% of them have to be dismantled a year just because of natural accidents. They're very fragile. And so the idea was we can use code to hop from the Microsoft Windows systems that are used to monitor the speed and pressure of these systems. And we think we can hop into the Siemens industrial controllers that control the speed of the centrifuges. And we think that if we do that, we could destroy Iran's centrifuges silently. And that is exactly what we did with Israel. We pulled off this attack that got into the PLCs, those industrial controllers. Some cases we spun them up and then we sat back for 27 days and did nothing. Some cases we slowed them down and then we sat back and did nothing. And all the while, when Iranian engineers looked at their screens, they saw everything running perfectly smoothly. And this was brilliant. By the end, we took out 1,000 uranium centrifuges. We set Iran's nuclear ambitions back years. We didn't get into World War III, and some even credit that computer worm with getting Tehran to the negotiating table because it sowed the seeds of doubt that they would never be able to enrich enough uranium for their bomb without interference from the U.S. and the Israelis. So short term, I fully credit that program with being a bloody masterpiece. That's what I call it. It really was the digital version of the Manhattan Project without the bombs. Long term, we don't know how, but it got out. And that's the thing about cyber attacks is once they're out there, they tend to get out. It got out and it was designed so carefully, clearly with a lawyer standing behind the engineer's shoulder, that it was designed to never do damage to anything that didn't match the exact configuration of centrifuges at Natanz. So it spun out all over the world. It showed up at Chevron in the United States. It showed up all over Asia, all over Europe, but it didn't do anything. But it was dissected. Security researchers poured through the code, and sure enough, they found out that this was designed to hit Natanz, later that it was the work of the US and Israel. And it opened everyone's eyes to the potential of code, not only for espionage, which everyone had been pursuing code for espionage, but for destruction. We also set this new precedent, as you alluded to, this Pandora's box moment, that so long as you did so with code, you had carte blanche to basically go into another country's critical infrastructure, their nuclear plants, and take out their centrifuges. That was the new rule of the world. Well, in the last 10 years since that was discovered, we've seen Iran close their capabilities gap because back then they didn't have basically any cyber prowess whatsoever. But now they've learned they're not at the level of Stuxnet, that worm. They probably couldn't do it if they tried today. But what they've learned is they can pull off a highly destructive attack with really basic rudimentary code. And we've seen them do it at Saudi Aramco a couple of years after Stuxnet was discovered. They hacked in and decimated their data and they replaced it all with an image of a burning American flag. And that was our big O-S-H-I-T moment because it was the moment we realized, oh no, they know the power of code and they are coming for us. And sure enough, they have hit us at Sands Casino because they didn't like something Sheldon Adelson said. They have probed our dams. They've been probing our critical infrastructure. And these days, last year, I was really shocked to hear security researchers say that Iranian hackers were the most prolific hackers targeting United States infrastructure, even more so than China, which, as I said before, was one of the most prolific actors we faced 10 years ago.
Sponsoring the show for this episode is Marquee TV. Marquee TV is a streaming service with a difference. It's bringing you the top tier of performing arts straight into your living room or onto your device. So think dance, theater, music, anything you might find in the West End, Broadway, or maybe a cool little experimental space too, but saving you the cost of a few tickets as well. I've got happily a bit lost in their vast library of performances, exclusive interviews, and behind-the-scenes content. Choreographer Jonathan Watkins' interpretation of George Orwell's classic 1984 was pretty cool, and I love the dance piece, Sutra, inspired by the skills of Buddhist Shaolin monks. And we've got a special treat for our listeners. Marquee TV offers 3 months of access for just 99 cents. That's right, 3 months for only 99 cents. With the code SQUARED, simply visit marquee.tv and use the promo code SQUARED to dive into the world of arts like never before. Bring the arts home with Marquee TV. We make a lot of stuff here at Intelligence Squared. So many great chats to enrich the mind, like the one you're listening to now. But like any business, it's really essential to be in good shape and keep things efficient so you can see the big picture all in one place. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you can cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems, and it's super easy to get started because NetSuite exists in the cloud, so no hardware needed, cutting your IT costs too. And you'll also improve efficiency by bringing all your major processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. That's why over 37,000 companies have already made the move. The cost of living crisis might not be making anything any cheaper, but there's real value in feeling on top of things, which is something I experience firsthand as an event producer every day. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared. netsuite.com/squared.
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
So we've been on this journey from Stuxnet, which I guess you might call the sort of high watermark of American cyber supremacy. And here we are in 2021, and we've got the SolarWinds hack, which you've alluded to already. But what went wrong for America in that time? And we've mentioned some of America's vulnerabilities, its openness. But it had this policy, Novus, nobody but us, and this idea of being active defense, or defense, as I should say in proper English. And the idea that actually if America was on the offensive in this area, then people wouldn't be able to attack it the way it was attacking other countries. That seems to have failed. And so talk me through why that failed. And also SolarWinds, I remember doing a bit of reporting on SolarWinds and getting quite different views from cyber experts, some saying this is a catastrophe, it's the longest, most deepest hack into, you know, American public life we've seen. Others saying this is just how we do business nowadays. We're in all the Russian equivalents. We're in all the Chinese equivalents. Welcome to the 21st century. So talk me through America's sort of the way it fell back in this area, and also SolarWinds, how bad a moment was that from your perspective?
Well, I'll start with the second question. I think SolarWinds, you're right. I mean, the people who call it an act of war, like Senator Durbin did, should realize that we've been doing this for a very long time. A couple of years ago, you know, you hear a lot about Huawei and 5G and this suspicion that Huawei is a big Chinese backdoor. Well, people forget that a couple of years ago, my colleague David Singer and I reported that the NSA was using Huawei as a backdoor. We hacked into Huawei. We use Huawei to hack on and get espionage and spy on countries that, you know, don't use American software, like North Korea and Syria and Sudan. And we saw, you know, we were using the same supply chain attack methods that Russia used with SolarWinds. So it's hard.
Could you just briefly explain what you mean by supply chain method?
Yes.
That was quite critical to how the SolarWinds attack happened.
Yes.
But
so
it's a particular form of attack.
Originally, my understanding is we broke into Huawei to look for Chinese backdoors. But once we were inside, we said, wait a minute, we can use these backdoors of our own to get into Huawei's customers, like China, like North Korea, like Syria government agencies. And we can use Huawei essentially as spyware to spy on these systems. And that is precisely what we did. Similarly, Russia broke into SolarWinds, this American IT company that's used just to get a sense for IT administrators to get a sense of what is on their network, what cloud applications they're running, and what devices are attached to it. And they said, wait a minute, this software is the lowest common denominator for a lot of sensitive government agencies like the Pentagon and the Department of Homeland Security and the nuclear labs run by the Energy Department and State and Justice and Treasury and Commerce, et cetera. It is also used by electrical utilities here in the United States. It's also used by more than 400 of the Fortune 500. In the UK, I understand it was used by the National Health Services. But for all the damage that these Russian hackers could have done using SolarWinds to essentially get into its clients' networks and wipe out its data, manipulate data, etc., we think that so far they only use this access to hack a few targets in the dozens, maybe 100 or so, and that they were after email and strategy planning documents. The same way that the United States used Huawei to hack government agencies and sensitive companies in these other countries. So we do the same thing. So it's very hard to call this an act of war, because what does it mean when someone calls out the NSA for doing the exact same thing? It also really limits our response, because we don't know how deep into our systems they got. If it's the group we think it is, the SVR, we know them very well, because in 2014, 2015, they hacked the White House and the State Department. And the people involved with that response told me it was like hand-to-hand digital combat. At one point, they even got into investigators' tools and manipulated it so that they could not spot Russian backdoors. So that's who we're dealing with, or if that's who we're dealing with, it's going to be a long time before we can eradicate every last Russian backdoor in our systems. And how do you respond to an attack when you're not even confident that you've eradicated the adversary from your own channels? You know, that's a really hard spot to be in.
So talk to me a little bit about the politics of all this. You know, I first arrived in America in 2016, and it was about August, September, and the whole election hacking of the Democratic National Committee was happening, and this whole issue was blowing up hugely. It then receded somewhat in the Trump era. It became politicized to some extent, so that Trump clearly felt that investigating this issue was somehow undermining his credibility as president. So I wonder how much damage that did. And then, you know, we obviously have a new administration now which is talking up this issue more. Do you think they're doing enough? Would you like to see more from them?
Well, I also just realized I didn't answer one of your other questions on active defense. But here's what I will say on that. It's short. We thought we could, by hacking into our adversary systems, not only could we kind of set up a system for mutually assured destruction. You know, if Russia turned the lights off here, we could turn them off there, or let them know that we would if they did so here. We also thought that we would be setting up an early warning system for these attacks. But clearly with SolarWinds, we didn't learn about SolarWinds from some epic NSA hack or hack by Cyber Command. We learned about it because FireEye, a private company, was itself hacked and tipped off everyone. So clearly this idea we can outsmart our enemies through offense alone is a fallacy. I'm not saying we should stop offense, because like I said, I thought Stuxnet was brilliant and it kept, you know, American soldiers from losing their lives. But if we're going to do that kind of offense, we better have a good defense too. So, okay, now moving on to your other question, which I'm already, the election. I mean, Trump, everything that happened in the name of cybersecurity under Trump happened in spite of, not because of, the administration. The efforts to get paper backups and records of ballots in 2020 was the work of officials at CISA who were basically operating under cover of darkness. They didn't want to advertise exactly what they were doing until we got closer to the election, when they wanted to make sure that people were confident in the accuracy of the vote because of the disinformation that was coming out of the White House and some of these far right channels and conspiracy theories. So, you know, there you go. But what also happened was that we changed the authorities. You know, under Obama, any attack that Cyber Command pulled off had to be approved by the president. Under Trump, they changed the authorities, either because Trump didn't care or because he wanted to delegate more power to his generals, or just because he didn't know what was going on. And in this,
probably some combination,
to be honest. So, you know, what they did was, and definitely under Bolton, when he was National Security Advisor, no longer was it the case that any attack by Cyber Command had to seek presidential approval. So what they did was they used that newfound authority to hack into the Russian grid in a really loud way. David Sanger and I broke that story, and we described them as making a loud show of it. You know, this was really aimed at deterrence. And what's funny is we actually went to the National Security Council ahead of publication. And as you know, usually those discussions are pretty painful. And, you know, sometimes they say you'll have blood on your hands if you publish this, et cetera. Well, we went to them and they said, oh, we have no problems at all with you publishing this, which just goes to show they wanted Russia to know we were doing this. And so, you know, we published that story and Trump singled us out for treason, and that became its own sort of news cycle. But, you know, where we went under Trump was offense. There was no coordinated defensive strategy. And we basically espoused this philosophy of active defense, that we would be okay as long as we were being as more aggressive about hacking our adversaries, et cetera. And I think, as I said earlier, that it is now time to focus on defense. You know, as someone said, America lives in the glassiest of glass houses. Yes, we're the most advanced player. We are also the most digitized. And, you know, I don't worry about PG&E. You know, I don't worry about these companies that have vast security resources and budgets to hire former NSA hackers and former Google guys to come in and protect their networks. I do worry about these smaller municipalities, these water treatment facilities in Oldsmar, Florida, where they don't have those budgets and they often have to outsource to supervisors and contractors elsewhere who monitor that the chemical levels and pressure and temperature is all working smoothly. But those same access points can be exploited by hackers. And we know we have determined adversaries, you know, in Iran and North Korea who want to set up their own battlefield preparations. And we've caught Iran's hackers in our dams, mucking around with the locks at a dam before. And, you know, in Israel, at the beginning of the pandemic, Israel called out Iran for breaking into a water treatment facility. Now, we have no idea whether those attacks are related, but clearly someone is trying to do some serious harm by exploiting these weaknesses and underinvestment in our infrastructure, which is owned and operated by 80% of it is owned and operated by the private sector.
So there's a line, I think, in the book, but certainly in your New York Times extract of the book, which says, "Everything worth taking has already been intercepted. Our personal data, intellectual property, voter rolls, medical records, even our own cyber weaponry." That was a line that really jumped out to me as somewhat terrifying from a personal perspective. Is that right? That, for, you know, my data is in the hands of the Chinese, is in the hands of the Russia. My sort of boring, sad sack Facebook messages to my ex-girlfriends or something. Is that all? Can I just give up on any idea that that stuff's private?
Yes. I mean, writing that line was almost liberating because I've been jumping from attack to attack. They always are, you know, it's like you jump from power grid to back to espionage to water treatment to intellectual property when you cover this beat. And just writing that sentence, I realized, oh God, you know, everything worth intercepting has already been intercepted, including our own cyber weapons. You know, someone, we don't even know who they are, broke into the NSA, or maybe it was an insider, we still don't know, and dumped their hacking capabilities and tools and actual code online. And that got picked up by North Korea and later Russia and used back on us. Our intellectual property is gone. You know, anything worth taking, China has taken over the last decade. That is not an overstatement. You know, Russian cyber criminals trade in our personal data, you know, and now it's our water treatment facilities and the power grid attacks I mentioned. And the Department of Homeland Security famously published a screenshot a couple of years ago with Russia's hackers' fingers on the switches of the controls at our power plant. So that's not a hypothetical anymore. And we know they hacked into our voter rolls. And we know that, you know, in the breach of OPM, China made off with information on everyone who'd ever applied for a security clearance, including their fingerprints in a lot of cases. So yes, you know, all of this has been intercepted. Now, the reason I try not to overhype this, and it's important to put it into context, is it matters who you are. So, you know, Russia and China probably don't care about you checking out your ex-girlfriend's photos or, you know, the messages you might have sent after a few too many beers after the breakup. But, you know, I think everyone needs to ask themselves, what is it that I have that is of interest and how do I lock it down? So for me, it's my sources. You know, I saw that firsthand with the Chinese attack on the New York Times. They were looking for our sources. So what do? I only communicate with people on Signal, the encrypted messaging app. If it's more sensitive than that, I don't communicate digitally with them at all. I had one source I would set up a standing dim sum appointment with on the first Tuesday of the month. We would never email about the location. We wouldn't bring our devices, and we would just go and, you know, sit in a corner where we could see everyone who might be looking or listening to us, you know, that kind of thing. And, you know, for most people, it is your personal data. And the easiest way to get your personal data these days is with what's called a password spraying attack, where they'll spray stolen passwords, common passwords at your account. And the best way to protect against that is to have a long password, different password for each account, and to turn on two-factor authentication and not click on stupid links and attachments. You know, sometimes we make defense sound really hard, and it is really hard when you're talking about SolarWinds and the Russian SVR, but it's not that hard when you talk about eradicating 80% of the threats we face, which come in the form of phishing attacks and password theft. And so there's a lot we can each do to protect our data. And yes, some of it might be long gone, but, you know, we are just at the beginning of this virtualization age in AI. And so, yes, we are rapidly adopting this wave of the Internet of Things and plugging in everything we can, but it's definitely not too late to step back and think about how best to defend ourselves. And it's not exciting. It's not Stuxnet. It's not sexy, but it's grueling and it's boring and it sounds really lame, but you know, like, we wear seatbelts and that was the biggest thing that we did to prevent right. deaths from car crashes. You know, the FAA set up a system, planes crashed, to make sure planes didn't crash so much, you know, but we have not done the same thing in cyber.
You reminded me, is it actually correct that SolarWinds were using the password SolarWinds 123 at one point? Can that really be true?
Yes, that was the password. And apparently I spoke with them and they said maybe it was an intern who had set it up at one point.
Right.
It's always, you know, blame the intern day.
Yeah, but that isn't more encouraging. Like, why would you have an intern setting up your password?
Exactly. Yeah. So, you know, there's a lot to come out. The one thing we don't know about SolarWinds is how they got in, but it doesn't even really matter because we're learning just how many ways there were to get in.
So you mentioned the Internet of Things. Obviously the kind of sci-fi dystopian version of this is that your fridge is going to be listening to you, your microwave is going to be videoing you, your Alexa is already presumably recording everything you're saying. I mean, how worried should we be as we, you know, the internet proliferates in every possible household appliance, often, I think, completely gratuitously. I mean, the fact that my doorbell is online just never fails to infuriate me. Like, it was a perfectly good technology before we had Wi-Fi doorbells, but whatever, I'm clearly a Luddite. How worried should we be about the proliferation of the Internet of Things? And it seems like, you know, for all that you can work on your defense in these areas, the technology is moving quicker than most ordinary people or even most governments can keep up with.
Yeah. Well, I think we've been asking the wrong question for a long time, which is, can we hook up this system to the internet instead of should we hook up the system to the internet? And we didn't have a big reason to ask should we until you start seeing these systems turn into zombie computers for denial of service attacks or spy devices and spyware. So now that we've seen our fair share of those attacks, and again, you know, not a hypothetical, there was one dissident I was in touch with who the government was spying on him because they didn't like some of his critiques of the monarchy on Twitter, and they broke into his baby monitor. You know, I've covered hacks of Alexa where just by shining a light at Alexa from across the street, you could capture the data that was going in and out of Alexa. You know, that, you know, nation state hackers weren't using that, cyber criminals hackers weren't using that yet, but security researchers have pointed out that it's possible. And what I've noticed in cyber is the hackers always go for the low-hanging fruit. And right now, we have so many gaping vulnerabilities in the software that has most of our data, being our phones and our, you know, Windows computers and PCs and phishing attacks and that kind of thing and password theft, that hackers really haven't had an incentive or a financial incentive to break into the Internet of Things just yet, but they're going there. I mean, 10 years ago when I was starting at the New York Times, I remember getting this call from this guy who said, you need to know about ransomware. Ransom what? He's like, oh, in Eastern Europe right now, they're holding people's computers hostage and they won't let your data go unless you pay $200. And I wrote about it. And I said, well, why isn't this in the United States here? And he said, well, there's just so much hacking to be done here in Europe, but I'm sure one day, you know, it'll make its way to the United States. Okay, now we're seeing hospitals locked up with ransomware for, you know, double digit millions of dollars in demands. So, you know, it's very likely that ransomware is going to be headed to our autonomous vehicles and to, you know, all of these systems that we've been mindlessly plugging into the internet. But like I said, it is not too late to defend these systems, to shut off the ones that we don't need. You know, yes, you know, if your doorbell is connected to the internet and it has a camera, that has its own security purposes. It also scares me because it means it could be used by a nation state to see when I'm home and when I'm not home and break into my house. So again, I think it kind of comes back to who's targeting you. You know, if you're a spy undercover at the Department of State or the Department of Commerce, don't have an internet-enabled doorbell. Don't use Alexa. You know, right. Take all of these OPSEC precautions. If you're, you know, the average American, like, you might not have to worry about this yet. And yet being, you know, maybe in 10 years, someone will lock you out of the house through your doorbell unless you pay, you know, $100 or whatever it is at that point. But, you know, it's not too late to make sure that we are considering security when we're hooking up these systems.
Well, look, if one thing comes out of this whole project, I hope it is that people stop having Wi-Fi enabled doorbells. So rubbish. So, you know, last couple of thoughts, really. You've talked about this. It's obviously in the ether. Do we need some kind of Geneva Convention for cyber warfare? Is it coming? I mean, as you point out, we're still really in the early days of all this stuff. Are we going to see some kind of public diplomacy on some of these issues in the coming years?
I think we are, because I think SolarWinds is so bad. It's so pervasive. It's so glaring. It's in so many systems that we consider sensitive that we have no way but up on some of these issues. It's hard on the idea of a digital Geneva Convention, because here's the thing, you know, we still are the most advanced player in this space. The United States doesn't want to handcuff itself by agreeing to norms that might limit our battlefield preparations and might limit this idea that we can stave off an attack with mutually assured destruction by, say, hacking into Russia's grid. And the other thing is, you know, on its face, I really agree we need some norms. It sounds really good. You know, let's all agree to not hack each other's hospitals or nuclear plants or elections or power plants or air traffic control. That seems really easy, like a no-brainer for all of us. The problem is, in the United States and the UK, the attacks come from inside government. Cyber Command does these attacks. The NSA does the espionage equivalent of the supply chain attack that happened with SolarWinds. We don't tap the guy at Google on the shoulder after hours and say, hey, you look really good at this stuff. You're coming with us tonight. We just don't do that. The problem is these other countries do, particularly our adversaries. In Russia, there's a very healthy relationship, or unhealthy, I guess, between the state and the cyber criminals. You know, like Putin said a couple months or maybe last year or so, no, maybe it's a few years ago, I've lost track of time. He said, hackers are like artists. They just wake up in the morning and start painting. Basically said, I have no control over them. They also don't extradite them when we indict them. They also don't arrest them. And the reason is they see them as a valuable asset for their own plausible deniability. You know, when Yahoo was attacked a couple of years ago and we finally pinned it down, it was four guys, two of whom were cyber criminals, and then two of whom were FSB agents. The cyber criminals mined all that data and sold it on the black market. But when they found an email account for a White House staffer, they passed it over to the FSB. So, you know, there is a degree of plausible deniability there. In China, where I've been covering these cyber attacks for the last decade, in the beginning, a lot of these spear phishing attacks and intellectual property theft were coming out of the PLA, the Chinese army. These days, they're coming from not just the Ministry of State Security, which is more sophisticated. They're coming from these satellite networks of contractors, some of whom are engineers at their day jobs at Tencent, who are very good at what they do, who China can essentially tap on the shoulder and say, hack, get this intellectual property for us, hack this foreign diplomat for us. So, you know, even if China and Russia agreed to these norms, they can always say, oh, we didn't know they were doing that, and jail that person. And we don't do that here. So, you know, that's another reason why the U.S. says it would never agree to some of these norms. So it gets very complicated very quickly.
Gosh, it seems like the when you were talking about the sort of Russian hacks, I kept thinking of Boris from GoldenEye. I don't know if you know that James Bond movie, but he seems to be like the sort of dominant figure of modern times, the kind of semi-criminal government sort of deniable hacker. You know, is there anything positive here? I mean, I've heard people argue before that hacking, you know, we saw that maybe with Stuxnet, that as terrifying as some of this is, it can act as a pressure release valve. Countries are able to damage each other and send messages without warfare or conventional warfare, as we would think it. No one dies necessarily, or at least we hope not. Is there a positive way of looking at this, that obviously we're in a bit of a Wild West moment, but norms will emerge, this will become a playing field which we understand more, security, personal security will improve? I mean, is there a positive case for looking at this in the future?
I think the only positive here is how far we've fallen. Yes, so with SolarWinds, you know, it's insider government networks. We think it's espionage, but in two clicks, it could be destruction. And, you know, they also have the ability to get into our utilities. And we know what they can do there because we've seen them do it in Ukraine. So we have no choice but to do something about our defense. My argument is not, let's stop doing offense. I actually think offense has a lot of value. Like I said, Stuxnet kept planes on the ground. It saved lives, and it might have gotten Tehran to the negotiating table. And yes, you know, a lot of what's being done in cyber is sort of this tit for tat, but it doesn't rise to the level of real war, which is why a lot of these countries see it as a perfect weapon. But we cannot continue on pace where we are, especially with the Internet of Things, with virtualization, with AI coming down the pipe. We need to shore up our defenses. And the good news is that SolarWinds leaves us no choice but to pause, to take stock of what is inside our network, to know how much of it is American made, where is it built, who's making it, how are they securing it, should there be liabilities here, should we be able to sue companies like SolarWinds for having SolarWinds 123 as a password that would have allowed a state like Russia or a low-level cyber criminal to get into these systems. You know, we should be recognizing the value of the hacking community in pointing out some of these holes and bringing it to the attention of companies. For a long time, companies just beat them over the head or threatened them with their general counsel and said, stop poking around our systems. That's changed a bit over the last 10 years as companies like Google and Facebook and Microsoft and Apple and others have started paying hackers who come forward with flaws in their system to get them fixed. So it is changing a bit, the incentive structure. I think the philosophy at Facebook, I say this in the book, was famously move fast and break things, get it out to market, worry about the problems later. Well, now they've realized that that's a flawed approach, that cybersecurity is important, that there are real life implications. In some cases, lives depend on the security of these products. And so when I went to Facebook a couple of years ago, what I saw graffitied on the wall was move slowly and fix your SHIT. You know, so the thinking on these things has changed, not nearly as fast or as quickly as we hoped they would. But, you know, that's the good news, is companies and individuals, and I hope with my book, people will read it and understand that they have their own levers to pull here in terms of forcing companies and pressuring government to stop leaving us more vulnerable, because that's what they've been doing for the last couple of decades.
Great. Well, I'm not sure that was quite a positive note, but it was at least more optimistic in that, as you said, at least we can take stock of where we are. And certainly, I hope your book is seen as a warning and not sort of an unheeded prophecy, shall we say.
Yes, thank you.
But I fear it might be the latter. Nicole, that was great. And thank you so much for joining us. It was a really, really fascinating interview. So thank you very much.